Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20-plus years of being together and collecting films on obsolete formats. And our film for this episode is the original Friday the 13th from 1980, and we have it on Hell's official format, CED, getting it actually in the year 2020 from the shop Pleasant Dreams here in Pittsburgh. And we have also this dynamic, and they're squeaking. We have a new puppy. It's been a minute since our last podcast. The end of the school year is quite something for both of us. And now we have two dogs. So they will at some point try WWE wrestling in our library at some point. But hey, maybe it just makes the background and the squeaking just makes the background
absolutely
more interesting, and the clicking of nails on hardwood and the growling and all of it.
Yeah.
Hopefully will not detract from our discussion of Friday the 13th.
Which, because it was on CED, we actually missed a couple of the kills because
it
actually skipped.
Yes, and I guess, you know, we haven't done a CED film in a while. We haven't done a podcast in a while. So it should explain CED, this really impractical format of a vinyl, what looks like a vinyl record in a plastic cartridge that plays movies. The format so bad it bankrupted RCA. We were actually just recently in a very cool record store in West Virginia, Assumption Records. And the folks there gave us some of their CEDs, and the owner said we were the first people he ever met that actually has a player, and we'll try to watch these movies. Same actually for Dusty at Pleasant Dreams. He's the one who handles the films at Pleasant Dreams, and his big thing is that I'm the only guy who comes in there to actually buys those things to watch them and not just hang them on the wall. So, and maybe they're better hung on the wall. Watching a CED, we had to try twice to get the movie started.
Yeah.
Had to put it in, take it out, put it back in to get it to work.
It did fuzz out a few times.
It skips where, like, literally shots will bounce back and forth as the needle try to find itself. There were parts where the film was wavy.
Yeah.
And worst of all, we missed the Kevin Bacon kill. The infamous Kevin Bacon arrow through the mattress, through his neck, outwards, as he's looking up.
Yeah.
Kill was, it just didn't play that scene. Sure that scene was on the disc at some point, but the big flaw of CD and why they're in those cartridge, big plastic cartridges, is, and you could see this one on our Instagram page, by the way, if you're like, what does this thing look like? Is because if any dust gets on the record, it permanently fuses.
Yeah.
So one little piece of dandruff, one little pet hair, one little whatever.
And you can't get it off.
You
can't get it off. There's no cleaning of it.
It's done.
And it's
so
done, it's done.
So we decided to watch this film on CED because we had it on CED.
And we decided because it's like in the middle of the summer, in the middle of summer camps, and it seemed very appropriate to watch Friday the 13th in the heat of the summer.
Yes.
Because it is one of the most infamous
summer camps. Movies. Yeah. And besides, we were going to do The Shining for the 100th anniversary of that party at the Overlook.
Turns out
we don't actually, we own it on Blu-ray, which is totally boring.
And yeah.
Looks really nice.
Yeah.
And doesn't skip.
Yeah. it's
very
VHS.
Detailed. But no, instead, we don't have it on VHS, we don't have it on anything. So instead, our big comeback episode is Friday the 13th on Hell's official format.
So Friday the 13th is interesting because it came out in 1980, and so would have been post-Halloween craze, because Halloween was an independent film and made a ton of money. So you had a lot of slashers that were coming out around that time, hoping to piggyback on the success of Halloween. So Friday the 13th was one of those. It is a slasher that was inspired by it. And also the director, Sean Cunningham, worked on The Last House on the Left. As we talk about the film, as I'm rewatching, it's like, oh, he must have been highly kind of influenced by Last House on the Left, maybe subconsciously, you know, not wanting to admit it, but there's an arc that's very similar to me.
Well, I think, and that brings up a point that I wanted to bring up, is the way in which Friday the 13th Part 1 almost isn't a Friday the 13th movie, right? Because there's very little Jason there. I mean, well, I guess we can spoil. It's been 41 years, folks. If you haven't seen this film and you're listening to the podcast,
or you haven't watched Scream,
or you haven't watched Scream, what are you doing with your life? B, turn off the podcast, go watch Friday the 13th, and then come back. We got 23 other episodes for you to enjoy.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the point of Scream, right? So, like, that's the infamous first scene of Scream where they're asking her questions. Drew Barrymore questions about horror movies. They ask her, who's the killer in Friday the 13th? And she, of course, says Jason. Everyone says Jason. Jason Voorhees is the killer. But this is not actually the case in this film. It's not Jason who's the killer.
Yes. And so, in some ways, for me, it's a film that's more of an exploitation slash hygiene film that more taps into that distant past of American horror than the contemporary slasher. It's like the genre-defining film that maybe isn't necessarily fully part of the genre.
Right.
And isn't maybe even, for me, fully part of the franchise because of the lack of the main character. You know, is a ghost, is a dream, is a figment of the killer's imagination or killer's memory.
And the final girl, you don't know if it's a figment of her imagination either, because she does have an experience with Jason at the very, very end of it. So you
she too is haunted by Jason.
Yeah, and so you don't know fully if it's a figment of her imagination.
Yeah, and so for me, what's more interesting is this film about how teen sex gets you killed.
Yeah,
which is still a thing in the slasher genre, and still plenty of a sleepaway camp and.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's even you can say the Freudian things about the Freddy movies, Nightmare on Elm Street and all that. But for me, it is this, you know, and for maybe for folks who don't understand in 1980, you know, going back two decades, if you wanted to see, well, TA and violence, right, you had to do it through an exploitation film and its close cousin, the hygiene film.
Yeah.
And so that you would have sex and violence, or skinny dippers, or games of strip poker, or in this case, strip Monopoly. But it had to be in this film that had, under the production code, this strong morality message.
Yeah.
That, in fact, stepping out of line will get you killed.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's much more common in cinema.
Yeah.
Of the middle of the 20th century. And yeah, I think the cinematic language that Friday the 13th taps into is closer to a 1940s hygiene film than it is to an 80s slasher. It's this weird bridge that brings the two things together.
I think people were still kind of figuring out the formula of the 80s slasher.
Oh, absolutely. But I do
think you're absolutely correct. I mean, we actually do have a DVD collection of these hygiene films. You know, and it's one of my favorite was the girl who gets supposedly is getting married and gets lured to being a prostitute in a house of ill repute
in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh, actually,
on the north side. Yes,
you know, I think you know for most people, it's going to be the you know, films about marijuana and things like that
or
we
you know
about.
I would still make the argument that Mom and Dad is the highest grossing film in American cinematic history, which again is a hygiene film you probably haven't seen. We own it on DVD. If we ever get it on VHS, we'll totally do it on the podcast. Well, but again, it's the movie, simple plot.
Yeah.
Girl meets boy. Girl, actually, they get married in secret, so even it's still the sex they're having is legal. Boy is an airman, dies in a plane crash. Girl and baby die during childbirth. And again, the message is, if you have sex, you will die.
Yeah.
And these campers, these teenage campers who are like in their late 20s, who look like they're in their late 20s, but they're teenage campers, getting wild, getting loose, out in the middle of nowhere, you know, away from any, almost any adult supervision.
Well, you know, they're the camp counselors, and they're there early, so it is plausible that they're 18 to 22, you know, if, like, they're in college and things like that.
Yes.
Camp counselors.
But those actors had to be, like, 27, 28.
I think Kevin Bacon was probably the one who's probably of age or something like that for that particular film. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So it is morality tale of the girl who doesn't even strip for strip poker, for strip monopoly, is the final girl.
Which, again, a lot of those 40s films are, like, you get right to the line and you think something's about to happen. And then it stops, then it rolls. I mean, if it was an early 30s film, you might have seen a little more.
Yeah.
But always get to that line, and then, we back off, jump cut, or something happens.
Yeah.
In this case, there's strip monopoly. You know, she takes her top off, she's down in her underwear, and then the rain starts, and she's like, I gotta, you know, do stuff in my cabin.
So the funny thing for me is because... The premise of the film is that Mrs. Voorhees was a cook at Camp Crystal Lake in, like, 1957. Jason was swimming. The counselors were off having sex. They didn't see it happen. They weren't paying attention to Jason. He drowned. And then the following summer, she murders those camp counselors, and they were actually having sex at the time.
Yes.
So the of the crew, so of course it's very convenient because you have three women, three men. That are part of it. Camp counselors that are men and three that are women. The only one actually who has sex is the Kevin Bacon character and his girlfriend.
Yes.
Everyone else actually doesn't have sex. They're
but
naughty.
But again, we get to the line. They're naughty, and you have a sense. It's going to be a long, hot summer. None of the guys, when they're doing chores, are wearing shirts.
Yeah.
There's lots of swimsuit action. They're on the lake.
Yeah.
It's only a matter of time. And if you keep watching, which I think also the weird pacing of the film is part of that. I mean, the kills start very slowly and the action maybe doesn't happen until the last third of the film. Or what you think this movie is, minus Jason killing everyone, is the last third of the film.
You know,
there's an hour of content before where it's the build. Where, in a sense, maybe they are building the cinematic language of the slasher.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, there is a kill early of the one girl who's hitchhiking who never even makes it to the camp.
Yeah.
And then there's a long lull and the storm and everything. And then the kills start.
Yeah.
Every slasher movie afterwards, you probably got to a kill... You know, you needed 30 minutes to get to a kill, not an hour.
Well, the pacing is very much a pacing of the 70s.
20 minutes to get to,
Yeah, I mean, the pacing is very much a pacing of the 70s film. That tends to be a little bit more meandering than what we're used to now, especially now. Like, with big budget films, you're so used to action.
Yes, you need a jump scare in the first 10 minutes
so
to
this
have
is
a contemporary horror.
Definitely is a lot slower, and you're right, the action doesn't happen really into the last third of the movie.
Of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, which again, people's perception of what this movie is. Watch the last 30 minutes.
So, you know, the funny part about it, because... The Cabin in the Woods, which is like a meta horror film, and so that has all the tropes, right? So it has the harbinger in the film, it has the last remaining girl, it has the fool, it has the hero, it has like the smart person, it has the sex kitten. And so, which is really funny, and so as I'm watching this, you're like, oh my gosh, yes, there are very distinct roles of, okay, she's definitely going to be the final girl. Oh, that's definitely the fool, the person jerking around. There was two harbingers in this film. There was the man who picked up the hitchhiker at the beginning, and then the crazy old man who said he was sent by God. So you have two harbingers who are warning you not to stay at this camp.
Which, again, thinking about borrowing cinematic language, Deliverance in this film, you know, bookending the 70s decades of, you know, country people are scary. I mean, there's also, again, the Mark Fisher thing about the weird and the eerie.
Yeah.
That, you know, the absence of people or the presence of people where there should be an absence, both things are eerie. Both things are scary. People where there ain't supposed to be people and just being out there in the woods without people, which, again, as a kid from New Jersey, understood. The woods were where you went to get murdered when I was a kid. I mean, that basically was it, including the woods next door to my house.
My favorite part, though, was the police officer who sounded like he was from the South instead of New Jersey.
Yeah.
They should have been like, more like, what you kids doing? What are you up to? You smoking some pot? Like,
yeah. Which, again, I think part of it also is, you know, it was shot in North Jersey, but, you know, there's the cinematic, a sense of, like, it's somewhere rural America. Also, people don't understand, if you've never been to the non-Boshwash Boston, Washington, New Jersey, that is that strip of land between Philly and New York, like, New Jersey in places actually looks like the rest of the country, or I would say looks like either the South or the Midwest.
Yeah.
The Pine Barrens look like the South, and that northwestern tip of New Jersey looks like the Midwest.
Yeah.
Though people in Jersey would be so offended if they listen to this podcast that the epic, we're so close to New York and Philadelphia state,
yeah,
and we have the shore, could possibly be compared to the South and the Midwest. But that's where you live, people. Yeah. Get over it.
Well, it's very beautiful, actually.
Yeah.
Where it's set is very beautiful, and it's still a functioning camp to this day.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really beautifully set. The interesting thing about it for me is also that you have Kevin Bacon early in his career. So he would have done Animal House, would have been his first one.
Yeah.
And then this, he did this. And he's the only one who ended up becoming a pretty big actor from this film. Nobody else did.
And I have to say, you know, a little piece of trivia, of course, if you count theatrical productions, we are 2 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Oh, that's right. That is right. Absolutely.
Through college theater, we were in a show with someone who did high school theater with Kevin Bacon.
Absolutely. And Kevin Bacon's also from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
He's from the Philadelphia area.
Yes.
So Kevin Bacon's the only one who, you know, was the big actor. So it's, you know, interesting to see him early in this role. He's actually killed relatively early in the film compared to
other people.
He doesn't have a huge role. He has a few lines.
Well, Jason's mother, the one who plays Jason's mother.
She had a career.
A modest career again, in the 50s and 60s. And so this is an odd casting for her.
Betsy Palmer, who was the actress, I believe the rumor is that she actually wanted to buy a new car, and they were going to pay her a few thousand to do this movie, to shoot some scenes for a day. And she's like, cool, I need the money for a car, and did it.
Which, actually, she does a good job. I mean, again, thinking about cinematic language, and having just watched The Shining last night.
Yeah.
The idea of the way in which, in that era, Hollywood portrayed mental illness and trauma in this really overwrought Freudian way that, you know, isn't quite as bad as if you listen to an earlier episode, Marnie.
Yeah.
But it is weird. I mean, there's times where she is speaking, you know, rather awkwardly, the voice of her dead son. And
saying, kill her, mommy.
Kill her, mommy! You know?
Kill her, yeah.
And, which again is, I think we have a much, well, I mean, we'll get to this in the latter half of the podcast, a much more nuanced understanding of trauma and mental illness.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you just kind of make a funny face, you're mentally ill in the 70s and 80s American cinema. You know, it's, that's all you got.
So
you're mentally ill and dangerous.
So it is. So it actually was a very profitable film. It cost like around $500,000 to make, and it grossed, I think, around $60 million. And so it was a very profitable film, as was Halloween. So, you know, Halloween came out. It was huge. I do feel like Halloween is the better film.
It is a much better film.
You know, Halloween, its pacing is better. The kills are better. The final girl is better. I think all of that is really, really interesting. But it's interesting that the director did work on Last House on the Left, which, if you haven't seen that one, it's an early Wes Craven. It's pretty brutal. But it does have a mom really kind of avenging something that happened to her daughter. Don't see the remake, because the remake stinks. It actually diminishes the role of the mom.
Yeah.
The original in the 70s really, like, that mom character is tough as nails. So I do think he was influenced by that because it did become a mom avenging the death of her child. Definitely the influence of Halloween, right? This, you have, you're seeing everything from the view of the killer, which is very much what Halloween does. So you don't have the reveal. You know earlier on, you know, in Halloween who the killer is. But you don't have the reveal to the very towards the very end for Friday the 13th. Yeah. So you can definitely see how it was influenced. And then Carrie at that time, that scene of Jason jumping out of the water and grabbing her is very much like that scene in Carrie.
Yeah.
In that nightmare where Carrie
jumps
out.
I was even thinking about Black Christmas, the original Black Christmas the POV kills, and that you don't know who the killer is until very late in the film.
Yeah. Yeah, so that you can definitely see the influences that are on it. But, you know, in the sense of, like, with Halloween, if you think Halloween is the pinnacle for me of the genre of these type of films.
Or the true genre defining. Because also, again, you have a whole mythology of Mike Myers.
Yeah.
That you I mean, I guess, is that what happened with the Friday the 13th franchise, to realize that that Halloween did it better.
Yeah.
And that you have this bankable commodity in your villain.
Yeah.
And they messed up and beheaded their villain.
Yeah. So when you, you think of the 80s, you think of Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, and Friday the 13th as the big three.
Yeah.
And you do see the reason why Halloween was the defining one of the genre.
Yeah.
And all three of them suffered from how many times can we make it,
and again, it's something that came up in the film class that I taught this spring semester.
Yeah.
That I missed dearly. We did a film podcast on, or no, sorry, we did a class on teaching in film and teachers in film, representations of teachers in film, and ultimately at the end of the semester. And I joked very early on, we were afraid that this was going to happen, but ultimately by the end of the semester, we were asking the question, is this movie Goodbye Mr. Chips or is it Blackboard Jungle?
Right.
And the successful, box office successful films that we watched all were a riff really on Blackboard Jungle with a little bit of Goodbye Mr. Chips in it.
Yeah.
And the unsuccessful films were films that tried to do something else.
Yeah.
And people don't like it when films try to do something else. Yeah. So the fact that if you could establish a villain, you could establish a formula, you can maybe put it in space one time or something.
Yeah.
You know, it just works. And you can always reboot it. After you put it in space, you realize you're out of ideas. You just make the first one again and call it a reboot.
Right. Which is, actually, all three have been rebooted.
Yeah.
With that. I mean, come on, Jason Goes to Space. Come on.
I mean, at least that was a lot more fun, actually, in some ways.
It was fun. It was very much fun. But I think, you know, kind of what has happened with all three of those films is because you've had so many sequels, and the sequels have just gotten progressively worse, that you kind of lose sight of kind of the nugget that was actually originally good about this film.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I do think there's some interesting things about this film. I do think it's interesting that the killer was a woman.
Yeah.
I do think that's really interesting. I do think, you don't like the pacing. I do think the pacing is kind of interesting in the sense because it isn't a nonstop kill, 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 kill until like the very end of it, which I think is kind of interesting.
I mean, I think it is interesting. And again, I think for me, it's just how this movie, this franchise with this movie, had not yet established its cinematic language yet.
Yeah.
And that everything just takes off on the runway. Once you've established the formula and you've proven that people love the formula and that you have a premise that other people can then watch again in different ways, your films are just much more efficient.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe that's not necessarily a good thing, and having the same damn movie over and over again. As someone who watched 10 different versions of Goodbye Mr. Chip / Blackboard Jungle for my job over the course of 15 weeks,
yeah,
A little variety's nice.
Well, and I think, you know, what ended up happening is, like, this big hokiness in the 1980s of horror films. And it had to become jokier and sillier.
Well, I think once you've climbed that mountain, what else do you do?
Yeah, which...
Or even become self-aware. I mean, you think even there's the scene as, like, the head counselor and the cop are being driven. The cop is giving the head counselor a ride back. You know, there's a line about, oh, it's Friday the 13th. You know, like, they had to mention it. And it's a full moon, and that makes people crazy. And then there's a crazy person on Friday the 13th. Like, so there is a little bit of that self-awareness.
Yeah.
Sort of in the film that you had to get there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like that kind of rushing to get out of a film on the coattails of another, there's always going to be a lesser quality to it, you know, that you absolutely see with it. You know, I think now we're used to that, you know, those films that something big comes out and like within a month or 2 months, there's the you know, kind of scaled down version of it. That was also, I think, still happening and kind of being learned about.
Yeah. And I think also, let's face it, I mean, if it's successful, try it again.
Yeah.
If it's successful, try it again.
Yeah.
You know, I love the, what was the Steven Seagal movie? Where, like, literally the tagline for the commercial was, it's like Die Hard on a boat. It's like, you know, that was the pitch.
Under Siege.
It's like Die Hard on a boat. It'll be great, you know? And you know that was just basically what they said in the pitch meeting. Green light this. Look how much money Die Hard made. We'll just put Die Hard on a boat. And so, yeah. It's like Halloween, but in a summer camp. And it's going to be not the kid who goes crazy for having seen people have sex. It's the mom who's avenging the kid because other kids had sex.
Yeah. You know, I always, when I also want to watch this, you always want to get a sense, is there any hint of, like, how Jason becomes supernatural? Like, even if there was, like, a flash of a satanic altar that mom had made.
Yeah.
But there's nothing that kind of gives you the sense that he's going to come back as this uber killer.
No.
This supernatural being.
You made a franchise and it worked.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And it does work. It works later. It works now. It works better. Maybe it works better than the technology we used to watch it on.
One of my favorite theories, though, is Jason is a deadite.
Oh.
I love that connection and crossover. Jason is a deadite. Yeah. Do you want to go to the questions?
Yeah, let's do that, because we're hitting probably close to 30 minutes. So, the big four questions. Those of you who watched earlier episodes only saw five questions, but we combined. So, question one, is a camp retro a classic or just an old movie?
I think it's campy. I think there's some camp to it. I don't know. What's your thought?
I think, in a way, because it exists in this liminal space, that it helps establish a new cinematic language in the new genre of the slasher, but has so much in common, like has more in common with a 40s hygiene film than you could ever imagine Scream having.
Yeah.
Or any of those other, a Cabin in the Woods, or anything that's on Shudder, basically, that we stream, that is killer somewhere, somehow is killing people in an environment, those entrapment films. I think in that sense, I think it's a classic, and I think it deserves to be watched. Though I could also imagine, you know, because horror fans can be very aesthetically conservative.
Yeah.
Well, it's not really a slasher movie because, you know, it's the mom and it's not really Jason and... I kind of was saying that, too. But, you know, that it defies expectations. And you get to see how the genre was established. And, again, a film, I think, that really wears its influences on its sleeve.
Which is interesting.
So blatantly. You know, almost sort of does make it a classic. Because you can say, oh, this is 1980. This is where we were from. You know, Last House on the Left, Black Christmas, Mom and Dad, going to...
Carrie,
Halloween.
So that does make sense. I guess I was looking at campiness in the sense of kind of how mental health was portrayed and then what it becomes. But I do think it is an important film, and so I will agree with you in terms of the classic. But also thinking the distance from hygiene films. We were born in the 70s, and we just kind of found out about them through other, you know, friends and connections and you know, theater and things like that. But, you know, someone born today really doesn't know what
Yeah, would not know. Is. I mean, they would. Someone born today would probably find, or a young person today wouldn't like Reefer Madness, would probably find the original 1936 Reefer Madness unwatchable. You know, which is a different way, which I think, you know, maybe slides us into this second question about the social political distance of the film. The portrayal of mental illness, I think, in a weird way, sadly, I think the teen sex thing, we're not that far enough away from it.
Yeah.
Which is sad and weird.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, we part of Pittsburgh, you know, it was just, what, 10, 15 years ago, the Silver Ring thing was developed here. It wasn't in the Bible Belt. It was Pittsburgh that gave us, you know, the new chastity pledge and all of that junk.
Even It Follows, which I really liked.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the same premise. You have sex with the wrong person and look what happens.
Or you just have sex.
Yeah.
You just have sex and you die. I mean, it's like the real outlier is Judy Blume's Forever.
Yeah.
You know, is that like they just, they have sex and then, you know, they move on with their lives.
Yeah.
And that's all that happens.
Absolutely.
No one dies. In fact, that was her daughter asked her to write that book, because, Mom, could you just write a book where they do it and no one dies?
Yeah.
Well, you know, which is hard. I think it's hard for our Puritan heritage to deal with.
Well, the thing I will say, and I to the character Adrienne King, who played the lead character Alice. Alice does have some agency, though. Like, you will say, like, she's trying to think and trying to problem solve for the situation.
Yes.
And even the other two women who were killed, they weren't the, you know, like, literally, it became such a huge trope, especially for Friday the 13th movies, of, like, the female camper or counselor out in the woods in their high heels or out in the woods.
Yeah, and they just know how to scream. The only thing they can do is scream, but no one can hear them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think also I could say, you know, also they look very normal.
They do.
The guys and the women look very normal. There's no plastic enhancement.
Yeah.
Or anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're skinny young people, but they're not voluptuously skinny young people.
Yeah.
Which is also, in a weird way, kind of refreshing, or you get a more realistic body image.
I miss that. Like, I literally miss that. Yeah. That was so nice to have that. So I do think that that's kind of interesting, that they are not enhanced, that there is some thought into what they're doing. Even the one girl, Brenda, when she's killed, she's actually going, she thinks she hears someone calling for help, and she's actually going to help a friend.
Yes.
Right. And so a lot of like what
so it's became, not helplessness. It's not also not necessarily bad decisions.
No.
It's not, oh, I'm going to go downstairs with a candle.
Yes.
You know, in high heels.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Or I'm not going to make the obvious choice in terms of getting myself killed. I'm going to stay here and go down the basement or something.
Yeah. I think that part of it is really interesting. On a sad side note, though, Alice, Adrienne King, she ended up having a severe stalker after doing that film. So much so, he actually broke into her house at one point and was held her captive with a gun. And she felt the need to leave the industry for a very long period of time and move to London, where her family is from.
Wow.
So on a sad, scary note, like, the characters, I actually felt like they did have some agency. You know, they were like, didn't always talk about boys all the time, and were like joking and things like that.
Yeah.
But in her real life, it ended up becoming this really scary misogynist thing that actually drove her out of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Which is actually kind of sad.
Yeah.
Sad to think about.
Question three. You know, the room test, technical distance question, I guess in terms of thinking about how this film looks. It is practical effects, not CGI.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Thank God.
CGI, I think we'll agree, CGI has ruined horror.
Yeah, I think, I mean...
You don't have to be creative, you don't have to be interesting, you don't even have to act. I think that was also our comment about The Shining. You don't have to do any of those things if you can just make a spectacle.
Right. Yeah, and we were having that conversation, like, now Jack Nicholson's face would have, like, morphed into, like, a demon.
Thing, and the topiary would have moved, and, like, it does in the novel, and all of that.
Yeah.
You know.
No, it's very practical effects. I mean, Tom Savini did the effects.
He's from Pittsburgh. They look good. They still look good 41 years later.
I mean, you could tell it's a fake head when she's beheaded. Like, you certainly could do that. But it's a quick shot. Yeah. But I do think the effects are relatively good. They are practical effects. It does rely on people acting. I guess one of the funny things is that Betsy Palmer was a stage actress as well. And so she's like, on stage, you actually hit people. So when they were doing their fight scene together, she actually hit her. And the director was like, no, like, you in film, you pretend to hit people. You don't actually...
Oh, wow.
You don't actually hit them. So, I mean, of course, I mean, there's also... it's camp, but it's also, like, physically a camp. But, you know, there's rotary phones. They're definitely pre-cell phone.
Yeah.
Pre-internet.
They don't have those problems. They don't have those problems of communication, of being always in touch. You now... have to write in the plot. If you have a captivity film, you have to write something into the plot where you just can't, like, use your phone.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, like, there was an Uber, the one counselor actually had to hitchhike because there wasn't public transportation to get there. She had to hitchhike. So there's, you definitely...
You do notice those things about the before time. Yeah.
A technical distance.
I mean, but the film still looks good.
Yeah.
Which then, I think...
Besides the format,
which I think gets to our final question of the big four, is it a keeper?
Absolutely. It is a very classic in the slasher genre. It is the genre figuring itself out.
Yeah.
And I do think it is well worth repeated watchings. I've probably watched this film hundreds of times now. Absolutely, you know, for me, of the three, it goes Halloween, Friday the 13th, and then Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
And actually, oddly, the more I watched Nightmare on Elm Street, the less good. But of that kind of big three of that era, I still really like it, and I still really like the concept of... I mean, at the core of it, it's actually a really sad story, you know, and... she doesn't fully say it, but she says Jason has to be watched because, and she hesitates, but when you see Jason, you realize, like, oh, either had some physical deformity or something else.
Yes.
That he had some problems and issues, and it's a devastated mom who's lost touch with reality and who thinks she's doing the right thing by killing all these people. It's actually a really sad story.
Yeah.
At the core of it.
Yeah, I would say it's a keeper. I think I would rather watch it again on VHS
or
DVD, God forbid, or stream it.
Yeah.
Of course, the interesting thing, too, about the CED, sometimes it degenerates, and sometimes actually dragging the stylus through the groove will knock things loose, and it will play better the next time, or it'll play worse. Who knows if we ever put it back in, maybe we'll get to see Kevin Bacon with the arrow shooting out of his deck. Maybe. But it's definitely a keeper. And on that note, I think we're out.
All right. Bye.
Bye.